Coming up on Simply Superior.
Simply Superior, news and issues from a superior point of view.
Are you ready to cast your vote for the Wisconsin Assembly? You will be with our Voter's Guide on the air. I'm Robin Washington. Join me for a digest of all local candidates from our recent regional debate series.
He's playing politics with people's lives here in Superior.
Well, I know that hundreds of thousands were left unemployed due to the government shutdown of businesses.
My question is, why did you cave to the political pressure from Governor Evers and your leadership?
This is a perfect example of the majority party not passing something that was just something nice to do.
All that, plus a roundup of the regional news, after this. Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. If somehow you missed it, there's an election going on, and it's more than just a presidential race, even if that is the mother of all political contests. The people you choose to represent you closer to home are also important, especially for local issues. Over the past few weeks, we've brought you debates of the candidates for the Wisconsin Assembly from our region. If you missed it, you can find them all at WPR.org and typing in Simply Superior in the search field. But with voting already underway, you can get a quicker digest of five of those debates right here during this hour. It's our Voter's Guide on the air, and we'll begin with the 28th District, which includes Polk and Burnett counties and part of St. Croix County. The candidates are the incumbent, Republican Gail Magnifici, who is finishing her first term, having been elected in 2019. She lives in the town of Dresser and grew up on a farm near Deronda. She's been a registered nurse for more than 35 years and describes herself on her website as a proud conservative with strong family values, small business owner, a pro-life woman, a longtime hunter, gun owner, leader, and fiscal conservative. We also have the challenger, Democrat Kim Butler. She lives in Milltown Township, where she and her husband own a small internet business. The couple moved to Balsam Lake 19 years ago to raise their two children. Before that, she was a Twin Cities TV producer for PBS Channel 2, the Discovery Channel, and other stations. According to her website, she was diagnosed with stage 3C breast cancer 11 years ago, which informs her stance on affordable health care for all and accessible health care for rural residents. I asked the candidates about state officials' handling of the pandemic. So let's move on to the first question, beginning with Ms. Butler. More than 500,000 residents have sought state unemployment benefits since the pandemic began. How do you think the legislature should be helping workers during the pandemic?
Well, unfortunately, our unemployment system is antiquated and not up to the task right now. For probably 10 years or more, it was well known within the legislature and in state government that the unemployment system needed to be upgraded, that the phone system wasn't up to par, that the computer system itself wasn't up to par. It runs on an old, I think, COBOL system, and it's certainly not the only state in the country that does that. But one of the problems with that is that you can only do one thing at a time on the computer system. So they can't input data and run the system at the same time. And they can't, when they're at night, they have to, you know, be inputting data. So they can't do other things. The legislature hasn't met since March or April. And so I think the first thing they could be doing is meeting and dealing with this problem and not just throwing blame at the governor for a system that he largely inherited. I think that they should be doing everything possible to, you know, up the staffing as much as they can. I know that people from all across the state government were pulled in to help people. But the main thing I think they need to do is, you know, stop the bickering and the posturing and political infighting about this and try and work with the governor and work with each other to come up with a solution for this.
Okay. Ms. Magnifici, same question. How do you think the legislature should be helping workers during the pandemic?
Well, I know that hundreds of thousands were left unemployed due to the government shutdown of businesses, and I didn't really appreciate who got to stay open and who had to close. They kind of picked and chose who was essential. And I know my office received hundreds of calls and emails asking for help. I probably spent the last 4 or 5 months helping people find their way through that. And I know there's still a huge backlog of people that are waiting. But when we met in April, Act 185 was passed in April. And that allowed the governor to transfer employees to other departments, such as to Department of Workforce Development, to help with these claims. But it wasn't until July that the governor actually did this. And I'm hoping that this helps with getting the people that the help that they need to pay their bills. I wish that I wish there was some kind of plan in place before this shutdown of the businesses took place, so that it would have been, because it just seemed like he said he wasn't going to, and then all of a sudden he did, and so many people were just out of a job. I'm sure it's over. I don't care what kind of computer system you have, with hundreds of thousands of people going on unemployment, it's bound to overwhelm any system that you would have. And I know there's still a lot of states that have this particular system. So I hope that they do try to improve that. I would go along with that.
Ms. Butler, any response to that?
Yeah, I mean, there's no way that the governor could predict what was going to happen and how cases were going to rise. What we were being told by the federal government in February and March was that, oh, this is nothing to worry about. And it really wasn't until March. I know that I had one of the last in-person meetings on March 12th. Mm-hmm. That this suddenly happened, and the government in Wisconsin, including the governor, had to be very nimble to try and do this. And, you know, public health and public safety has to be paramount, you know, making sure that people's lives are safe first, and then, you know, working on making sure that they get unemployment, that aid is going to small businesses, and that, you know, extra unemployment is going to people as well. But this wasn't something that he really could have predicted was going to happen.
Gay response to that?
Well, I guess some of it is kind of predictable. I mean, if you shut down certain businesses, and then I didn't approve of him saying that it was okay for Menards and Walmart to stay open, and then you shut down all these other businesses. I just didn't approve of that. So there were just too many people out of work. I talked to so many people that were in jeopardy of actually losing their business. They had their mortgages and their retirement, everything tied to their business, and then to have it just shut down saying they were not essential. And I just think that every business is essential.
All right. For Ms. Butler, along the same lines, do you support Wisconsin's mask mandate as championed by Governor Evers? And would you support an extension of it if the public health crisis warrants it?
Yes, I do. I think Wisconsin today is listed as the fourth highest or fastest growing rate of COVID cases per 100,000 in population. And we are quarantining entire dorms of students at the UW system schools, and in-person classes are shutting down at our schools, and, you know, the rate is climbing here in the 28th District. Burnett County is one of the highest, fastest-growing counties in the nation, and the load continues to grow in Polk and St. Croix counties as well as the neighboring counties. So I think that all of that is happening basically because the mandate has not been enforced uniformly. And if we look at science and we look at other countries who have had mask mandates and strict usage of masks, those countries are getting back to normal. They are reopening. You know, people are in restaurants again, kids are going back to school, and that's not happening in the United States because people were so against wearing masks I've been someone that's been wearing one since March, whether or not I'm supposed to wear one, because, you know, decades of science have proven this. We do business in Asia, and we're used to seeing people in Taiwan always wearing masks on public transit. They learned in, I think, you know, the SARS or swine flu outbreak that that's just what you do to protect public health. So, you know, I don't like wearing a mask. I have asthma. I have breathing issues. But I wear it because I know that that's the single biggest thing I can do to help keep everybody safe and get the rates going down. I have a student at UW-Madison, and she, you know, didn't feel safe in the dorms and ended up moving off campus. And we're seeing, you know, what's happening because of that. Now all the dining halls are closed, and, you know, kids are stuck in certain dorms, and all in-person classes are off. Most of the classes were virtual to begin with. But we have a problem here in Wisconsin, and it's increasing. So I think the last thing we need to do is stop wearing masks at this point.
Okay. Ms. Magnifici?
I do not support it. First of all, let me just say I really care about the health and safety of everyone, but wearing a mask should be a choice, not a mandate. I think you should respect everyone's personal space and practice good hygiene, which includes frequently washing your hands with soap and water or use hand sanitizer when that's not available. And try not to touch your face. I worked in the hospital actually taking care of patients with all these other various viruses. And, you know, to protect myself, yes, I did wear a mask. But just to treat everybody like they have it or that they're asymptomatic is kind of unreal. I just feel like it's not the government's job to protect my health. That's my job and my responsibility. I think it's the government's job to protect my constitutional rights. As far as the mask mandate goes, I was just really disappointed that the governor, his lack of collaboration with the legislature before issuing it. And I believe our local governments, our businesses and citizens have already done a great job to appropriately and safely respond to the virus. I just don't think a statewide approach is the best for the interests in Polk and Burnett County.
That was an excerpt from our debate featuring the candidates for the 28th District Wisconsin Assembly seat, incumbent Republican Gabe Magnifici, and her challenger, Democrat Kim Butler. If there's anything close to an urban area in our region, it's the 73rd District, which includes most of Douglas County, including all of the city of Superior, and the northern portions of Washburn County and Burnett County. The candidates are the incumbent, Democrat Nick Milroy, who has served in the seat since 2009. A graduate of Superior High School, he enlisted in the United States Navy and was deployed to the Persian Gulf. He continued his service in the Naval Reserves while attaining a biology degree at the University of Wisconsin-Superior. Nick has taught biology and worked as a scientist for state, federal, tribal, and private organizations. He served two terms on the Superior City Council and describes himself as the only scientist to serve in the Wisconsin State Assembly. Nick's wife, Julie, is a public school teacher, and they have three children. We also have the challenger, Republican Keith Kern. He also grew up in Superior and graduated Superior High School in 2003. At 20, he began managing his family's business, Jimmy's Saloon, and purchased it in 2016. He now operates it with his wife, Emily. Among Keith's civic activities are positions with the Tavern League and the Lake Superior Ice Festival. He's also raced stock cars for 20 years. In 2016, he was elected to the Superior City Council and later served as council president. Here is an excerpt from their debate. Mr. Kern, following the shooting of Jacob Blake by police in Kenosha, Assembly Speaker Robin Vos created a task force to address issues related to policing and racial disparities. The Evers administration had proposed a package of 9 bills after the death of George Floyd in May. Do you think either of these plans can seriously improve the relations between police departments and the state's African American community?
Well, I think a lot of that 9-point deal that was presented by Governor Evers is already being addressed by most of law enforcement. I know that I've had talks with our police chief up here, and some of the points of those bills are being addressed. You know, it's a shame of what happened down there, and the destruction that has caused, and the anger and hurt that people are doing, but I cannot get on board with the fact that the rioting and protesting and burning down of things. Now, we have to have law enforcement to be able to take care of issues that we have, that we have a judicial system that is going to address any of the issues that are going on, especially if there's, you know, things that are happening with officers. I know in Superior alone, we're looking at hiring social workers and increased training and allowing for officers to understand and train themselves better and make sure that they're more equipped to handle situations that they might face on the street. I think it's a plan that we all need to continue to work on, and I like to see that we're making steps for it. But if we're alluding to defunding police or allowing for this type of activity to happen, I just cannot go along with that.
Okay. Mr. Milroy, following the shooting of Jacob Blake by police in Kenosha, Assembly Speaker Robin Vos created a task force to address issues related to policing and racial disparities. The Evers administration had proposed a package of 9 bills after the death of George Floyd in May. Do you think either of these plans can seriously improve the relations between police departments and the state's African-American community?
Well, I think they both have the possibility to do that. I think it's important that the governor work with the legislature, no matter which party is in charge, to take into account the issues that they bring to the table with respect to issues like this. But more importantly, I think it's important that we have elected officials that recognize that we have a racial disparity issue in this country. If we want our state to thrive, all communities must feel safe and have opportunities to be successful. And that's not happening right now. But it's not only racial disparities. We see that even here in northern Wisconsin, where we've been left behind by the Republicans and the politicians down in Madison and Milwaukee when it comes to health care and education and corrections and mental health care access. These are the same issues that we're seeing in the inner city, that we see in rural areas, and all the whole spectrum of it needs to be addressed to try to deal with these issues. I'm also appalled at the rioting and looting that took place down in Kenosha. Destroying other people's property is never okay. And those who are intent on destroying other people's property should be arrested and charged to the fullest extent of the law.
All right. Moving it closer to home, but also on race relations. Would you support adding an S to Douglas County to rename it for Frederick Douglass rather than Stephen A. Douglas, for which it is named? Why or why not, Mr. Kern?
To me, I don't think it really much matters. I mean, if we're trying to erase history or change names on things, it was named after that individual for a reason, and that's what I believe in.
All right. Mr. Milroy?
Well, that is an interesting proposal. Obviously, Frederick Douglass is a very important figure in our nation's history. He was one of the leaders that led the abolitionist movement, and I think we need to honor people like that in our country. I don't know that we necessarily need to change the name of counties, but we really need to look for examples of leaders that were ahead of their time, and Frederick Douglass is one of those people.
That was an excerpt from the debate of candidates for the 73rd Assembly District seat, Nick Milroy, the incumbent Democrat, and Keith Kern, his Republican challenger. You're listening to our Voter's Guide on the Air. We'll be back after this. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. You're listening to our Voter's Guide on the Air, featuring excerpts from our debates of candidates for the Wisconsin Assembly from our region. Next is the 74th District, which includes Ashland, Bayfield, Iron and Price counties, and a portion of Douglas, Sawyer, and Vilas counties. The candidates are the incumbent, Democrat Beth Myers, who has served in the seat since 2014. She hails from Bayfield and holds a bachelor's in sociology from Northland College. She spent 9 years working for the Red Cliff Tribe, most recently heading its Family Services Division. She later was executive director for CORE Community Resources, a community-based nonprofit serving seniors in the Shawamigan Bay Area. Myers spent 5 years on the Bayfield County Board before her election to the Assembly. She lives in the town of Russell with her husband, Kevin Buzicki. We also have the challenger, Republican James Boland. James has more than 2 decades' experience in resort management. He's a board member on the Bayfield County Economic Development Corporation, helping to organize cross-country skiing events like the Wisconsin State Nordic Championships and the American Berkey Binder. From 2006 to 2019, James was executive director for the Cable Area Chamber of Commerce. He successfully bid on International Paralympic Committee World Cup events in 2012 and 2013 and served on the organizing committee for the 2015 championships. James and his wife Heather live in Cable. Here is an excerpt from their debate. Ms. Myers, you co-sponsored a bill with 21 other Democrats and 2 Republicans. It sought official sanction to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the creation of the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore. Unfortunately, it failed. What should you have done to bring Republicans along on what would seem to be a fairly non-controversial measure?
Robin, that's a really good question, and it's much bigger than this one particular bill for the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore. We need to work together. This is a perfect example of the majority party not passing something that looks quite benign, actually, right? No one was going to be hurt. And if I remember correctly, there was no financial commitment to this. It was just something nice to do. And that's an example of the majority party not working across the aisle to get something done. There are many important bills that have been entered or introduced in the legislature that can't see the light of day. And I'd like to talk about one of those that I think is extremely important. I was a co-sponsor for the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women Bill. And that bill that would have established a task force to look at this issue, couldn't get a committee hearing while we were in session. Towards the end, it got a committee hearing. I sat in that room for hours hearing the heart-wrenching stories from families who have lost their daughters and young girls and community members because of this tragic situation. That got a hearing at the end of the session when we weren't going to be back on the floor, which everyone in the building knew it was going to die in committee, and it did. And then Attorney General Josh Call picked it up, and he is working on establishing a task force because he doesn't need the legislature to do that. So thank you for asking the question about the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore, but it just is highlighting how important it is that we work together on important issues when we're on the assembly floor.
Thank you, Ms. Myers. Mr. Boland, a different version of the question since you weren't in office. First, can you see yourself being one of only 2 Republican co-sponsors on a bill with 22 Democrats? And secondly, would you have supported celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore?
Not only would I have gone across the aisle and supported it, I was actually in Bayfield when the U.S. Mint released the Apostle Islands quarter. And you know, it was incredible to see how many people showed up from around the nation to celebrate the launch of that quarter and the importance that the Apostle Islands plays here in northern Wisconsin. You know, our natural resources are second to none. And the Apostle Islands and the 50th anniversary of it should have been a nonpartisan issue. What I have found is I've had various members of the legislature up here and sat down and had conversations with them. And I find that, you know, they don't necessarily know or understand the issues that are impacting our area because they know their area. And again, as I said in my opening statement, I think it's your legislator's job to make sure that you explain those things and have those conversations. And so, you know, I certainly would have stepped across the aisle, and I don't think that that necessarily needed to be a partisan issue. I think that, you know, if you can make the argument, and that's why I say I want to go down and be a stronger voice for us in Madison, because I think that we need to be able to have those conversations and get people to step across the aisle, especially on issues that are non-partisan, non-political, non-confrontational. We certainly should be able to find commonality there. And so the work that I did in the chamber, working with people across the aisles, with, as I mentioned before, Secretary Frank, who served in the Doyle administration, you know, I had some very good, strong conversations with him on the management of the bear populations and deer populations and the impact that that was having on the economy. And and we talked after some of those public comments, and he thanked me for the way that I framed my questions. And it really was about trying to find answers and move forward. And so I think that's exactly what we need to have in Madison, is a representative who can actually move those projects forward and find common ground. And to do that, you have to be willing to step across the aisle yourself.
Thank you. Ms. Myers, any rebuttal?
Yes, I do. I have reached across the aisle, and I have talked with my colleagues about important issues in the Capitol, including being selected for two of Speaker Voss's task force, one on foster care and one on Alzheimer's and dementia. And we did work together. So the media and some people would like us all to think that it's constant bickering in Madison, because it's like if you go out on a boat on a sunny day and come back and tell everyone you had a great time, they're not as interested as if you were to say we went out and the waves were big and there were white caps. So the media likes to grab on to the hot stories, but there's a lot of good work that goes on between the aisles and between people who care about the issues we're working on. And I'm one of those people. I know how to work across the aisle. Where the bottleneck happens, it's with the Speaker's office. And he gets to say what bills get to the assembly floor and what bills are going to get a vote and what committees get to have a hearing. So let's put the blame where it needs to go. And I think we have a lot of work in Madison we could do together.
Thank you. Mr. Boland, a rebuttal to the rebuttal?
Yeah, I think that it's one thing to say that you can reach across the aisle, but then sit there and give example after example after example of where Republicans haven't been able to work with you. If you're able to work with them, great. If you're not, then that could be an issue. And so by Ms. Myers' own admission, she says that Speaker Voss is the problem. And so if she's saying that she cannot work with Speaker Voss, you know, and he's the assembly speaker who makes those decisions, then maybe it's time we send a different representative down there who can get those things done.
That was an excerpt from our debate for the 74th District candidates, incumbent Democrat Beth Myers and her Republican challenger, James Boland. My colleague Dean Kallenbach moderated the next two debates for the 75th District and the 87th. In the 75th, incumbent Republican Romaine Quinn is not seeking re-election, so there are two candidates vying for the open seat. The candidates are Republican David Armstrong of Wrights Lake and Democrat John Ellison of Shell Lake. Here is an excerpt from their debate.
The 75th Assembly District includes all of Barron County and parts of Washburn, Burnett, and Polk counties. Our guests today are Republican David Armstrong of Rice Lake. He's currently the executive director of the Barron County Economic Development Corporation. He's a former Rice Lake City Council member and presides over the Rice Lake Cable Commission. He also serves on the city's Utility Commission and Tourism Commission and is on the board of the Rice Lake Chamber of Commerce. Also with us today, Democrat John Ellison of Shell Lake. He earned his bachelor's degree from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where he captained the Badger basketball team. He earned his master's degree in school counseling at UW-Superior and is currently a school counselor serving in the Barron Area School District. During this century so far, Wisconsin has dropped in per-pupil spending from 12th place to 24th place. Still, aid to schools is the largest spending category in the state budget. It makes up 35% of tax revenue expenditures. So, John Ellenson, you're in the schools. Talk about your plan for school funding.
Well, it's really quite interesting because they talk about that private tax credit. And in the 75th, we really don't have those private schools. And so when they talk about it going to private schools, it doesn't help us up here because we take pride in our public schools. And you look, if you drive throughout the 75th, whether you go to Cumberland or Shell Lake or Barron, Rice Lake, Cameron, we have wonderful schools and people take a lot of pride in their schools. And it shows. It's fun to see what the kids are doing and what they're learning. About a decade ago, we saw that defunding of education, and we saw what it did. We went from 12th down to 24th. We're usually first or second in the nation in the ACT test, and we were doing very well, and we've seen that reduction. And I've seen it firsthand because in that last decade, we've gone from having anywhere up to 200 applicants for a job, and at a minimum 50 to 100, and now we see that reduced to maybe two or three or none at all for months on end, or then we get someone into the position that needs to earn their license. So that defunding of education has hurt education. So when I think about, you know, them doing it to the police department, it's just not a good idea because of just the morale and what it's done to education. We need to fund our schools. Those are good-paying jobs. I think about the men and women I work with who only work 25.5 hours because if you work any longer, then they have to pay health care, and then they have to juggle one job to the next. And these are people that work really hard. They work hard. They work two jobs, and then they have a yard sale to make ends meet. And as a society, we need to step up. We need to pay for our education. We need to help our families grow. We need to build our communities. When we have strong schools, when we have healthy children and healthy families, that makes for a stronger community. A stronger community makes for a stronger economy, a stronger local economy. So supporting our education is just a primary engine for not only innovation, but for a brighter future for all of us. So education, I'm very passionate about. It's something that, as you look around our community, we all care about our schools. There's amazing things going on. So, yes, we do need to fund our schools, and we do need to increase that funding for our communities.
David Armstrong, how should the state support public schools, and where are you on school vouchers?
Actually, what I've been doing right now, it's been fascinating because I've met with three of the administrators from school districts already here in Barron County with that exact reason, that exact question. Right? You need more money. Where do you need the money exactly, and what do you need? And the thing I found is, wow, does it differ from school district to school district? That's been, I guess, most eye-opening thing through this whole expedition I've been on, and I'm going to meet with the rest of them in the next 2 weeks. What I found is, well, one underlying thing was I went back to the Blue Ribbon Commission that they had on education and all of the suggestions that they came out for additional school funding, and again put that to the school districts. And there again, it was interesting because none of them could really agree on, you know, this issue was important to one, another funding issue was important to Rice Lake, Cameron liked another. So that's been my goal at this point, is to reach out to all the school districts, and I would think the low-hanging fruit would be a commission did this work on it. What can the legislature take from that and implement that's going to help? All right. The one thing I found, too, by both my work as president of Law Enforcement Foundation up here and talking to the schools, is the need for mental health and that kind of experience or expertise in the school districts. The one question I had to all of them is additional help with mental health best served by a school person on staff, or maybe by CISA or an outside. And kind of uniformly, it was, it's best to have that person in the schools, in the school district, dealing with the schools on a full-time basis. I get that, all right? And that's something that absolutely I'll be working for. We ended up working with the city of Rice, or the Rice Lake School District last year, because the question came to them of, is there kids that you miss each year? You know, school counselors, you've got, what, one to every, I don't know, 200-300 kids type of thing. So you don't get a lot of work with them. And what we ended up doing in Rice Lake in a pilot program, we brought in workforce resource, put together, they found funding for a person, put together a program where we met from January on until, unfortunately, COVID hit, with 33 of the kids that were maybe on the bubble. Maybe they would graduate, maybe they weren't. No clear pathway going forward out of school. Hadn't done their academic career plans. Maybe they had an idea what they wanted to do after school, but it was unique, let's call it. So what we ended up doing was working every Tuesday, every Thursday, again, from January on, with the idea of, all right, borrow something that we had taken from the poverty to prosperity piece, which was called the bridge to prosperity. The bridge being, all right, here's your goal over here. Let's build a bridge to it. Well, we tweaked that to the school district in Rice Lake and to the kids. And, all right, there was two pillars you had to do. Number one, you have to do your academic career plan. Number two, you have to graduate. All right. And then we worked with them. All right, what's your goal and how do you get there? And it was fascinating to see the change in the kids from the first meeting until we got to the end. And unfortunately, like everybody knows, COVID hit. But at that point, we had every kid graduating, plans for most, but it kind of fell apart. We kept up with a few of them afterwards, but that's the kind of thing, too, is I like to see how much other public-private partnerships can be done to help the school district as well. So I guess to sum it all up, definitely looking for ways to put more funding into school districts, and I'm going to continue my meetings with the administrators and the business managers, because that's been fascinating as well, to see what's needed.
That was a debate between the two candidates vying for the open seat in the 75th District, Republican David Armstrong of Rice Lake and Democrat John Ellison of Shell Lake. And finally, the race for the 87th District seat. The district includes all of Rusk and Taylor counties, most of Sawyer County, a part of northwestern Marathon County, and a part of northwestern Clark County. The candidates are Republican James Edming of Glen Flora, who is seeking his fourth term in office. He's been a farmer and a business owner and created Jimmy Boy Pizza. Challenging him is Democrat Richard Poulter. He has a degree in economics and is retired from the Clark County Healthcare Center. He lives in the town of Lublin. Here is an excerpt from their debate.
Next legislature will be redrawing legislative congressional districts. Richard Poulter, you've spoken out in favor of nonpartisan redistricting in your past campaigns. How would you see that happening?
Well, we have a nonpartisan group of people who do the redistricting. In 2010, it was done by the legislature, and the Koch brothers had spent over $1 million on specific candidates to make sure that they had an advantage in both the Senate and the Assembly so that they could redistrict according to their wishes. To me, that is unacceptable. And the Republicans are the ones that the candidates put their name on, but even if they did it to Democrats, I would be against it. Nonpartisan redistricting means that issues count. It means that people count. And when you have gerrymandering, first of all, you have the people that are gerrymandered out of legislation that don't have a voice. And then secondly, the people who did vote and are in office, their representatives understand they don't have to answer to them. So impartial redistricting is terribly important.
James Edming, you're currently in the majority party. Are you satisfied with the legislature's current role in drawing the district lines every 10 years, or would you support a change in favor of a nonpartisan method like the commission Governor Evers has set up?
Well, if you look at, and we get blamed for gerrymandering all the time, but you have to remember, maps being set up, you can talk about the Koch brothers and what the Republicans are doing and all that, but the way the maps are drawn are in the Constitution. Now, you may think I'm a good legislator or a bad one. That's beside the point. But I can't change the Constitution. That's a major issue. And Krista, I think you were at the town hall meeting when you folks hit me about this, and I'm gonna say the same thing. I don't care where you put me in the state of Wisconsin. The people will pick the best candidate, and I will outwork anyone that you put against me. I used to have when Mayor Williams had this spot, Representative Williams, Price County was in on it. And now what's happening is, guess who was adopted to Price County? They adopted me as their representative because they couldn't get stuff done that they wanted to get done. It's not gerrymandering and all that. It's how hard and what you can get done. So I actually have another county. I go to their meeting. I've never seen anyone come to our meetings from the other side. But if the Constitution has it set up, it would take an absolute more than an act of Congress to change it. To change the Constitution takes a long, long time.
That was a debate between the 87th district candidates, incumbent Republican James Edming of Glenflora, and the challenger, Democrat Richard Poulter of the town of Lublin. Moderator was my WPR colleague, Dean Kallenbach. And that completes our Voter's Guide on the Air. And if you missed any of it, you can find it on the web at WPR.org and type in Simply Superior in the search field. Our regional news and review is next after this. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington, and I'm joined by Brooks Johnson of the Star Tribune's North Report team. Hello, Brooks.
Hey, Robin.
And our own Superior-based reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio, Danielle Kading. Hi, Danny.
Hi, Robin.
So how many more days until Election Day, or does it matter? Danny?
It does still matter. Yes, absolutely. Many people are voting early because of the coronavirus pandemic, and more than a million people in Wisconsin have already returned absentee ballots. And this week, more than 75,000 people cast a ballot of early in-person voting on Tuesday. But that still accounts for just a little more than a third of all votes that were cast in the 2016 presidential election. And here in Superior, around 4,000 people voted absentee in the last election, the last presidential election. And so far, 6,000 have voted by mail, according to City Clerk Terry Kalan. Right now, Superior election officials, along with others, are working with law enforcement to make sure that polls are safe and secure for voters who do show up on Election Day. And there have been some fears of voter intimidation after President Donald Trump called on his supporters to monitor polls for signs of election fraud. Kalan says people are welcome to come and observe as long as they follow the law. But she noted that a young man was asked to leave a polling place this past spring after he was loud and disruptive with voters. Wisconsin law prevents poll watchers from interacting with voters. So if there are any issues this time around, Kalan says they'll have immediate access to law enforcement to keep things from getting out of hand. But no uniformed officers will be present.
Mm-hmm. Well, one reason to vote early is to avoid lines on Election Day because of the pandemic. In the meantime, you also have to worry about the regular flu.
Yeah, because seasonal flu resulted in around 400,000 hospitalizations last year and 22,000 deaths. And so in order to avoid a twindemic, as health officials have called it, they've been urging people to get their flu shots early this year. And so far, that's working. You know, more than 280,000 people, I believe, have already gotten the flu shot in Wisconsin at this time right now compared to the same time last year. But that's causing a problem because there have been some temporary shortages of flu shots for some local health departments, and that includes Ashland County. They ran out of their supply, and they've put in another order, but right now it's unknown when that'll come through. And basically, the Wisconsin Department of Health Services is that there is ample supply of the flu vaccine. The problem is more of a demand and supply. So right now, they are seeing some delayed shipments, but they expect to have all the flu shots they need. And if people need to get a flu shot, then they should look to other providers or pharmacies in the area.
Well, thanks for giving me a new word, twindemic. I did not know that one. Moving back to the election and back on the Minnesota side. Brooks, the Democratic Farmer Labor Party, is fighting to keep the labor part of their voting bloc.
That's right. And in the 8th district, they're having some trouble. So northeastern Minnesota's congressional district, which is geographically massive and covers areas from just north of the Twin Cities to the Canadian border to International Falls and is centered on Duluth. Several labor unions have endorsed the Republican candidate, Pete Stauber, for his reelection campaign. Stauber is just the third Republican to win a seat in the 8th District since World War II. The DFL coalition, led in large part by Iron Range labor-heavy politics, kept a DFLer in that seat for more than 6 years straight. But now it's becoming more of a swing district and one that President Trump has brought a lot of attention to, as his administration and he himself has visited several times.
Well, heading back down to the Twin Ports, I understand there's a lot of activity going on the housing front.
I don't know what metaphor to use. It's on fire. It's rolling along.
I hope the houses aren't on fire. That would be a different issue.
The market itself is quite lively, let's say. In September, the median sale price in the Duluth area reached just over $200,000, which is up nearly 20% from a year ago. And September is a month that typically sees home showings and sales slow down. But instead, we saw showings up 40% as a lot of people are playing catch-up because they couldn't put their houses on the market or didn't feel comfortable doing so in March and April in the early months of the pandemic. Realtors I talked with say, you know, not just Duluth, but Superior is getting a lot of attention too. Folks who might be moving up from the Twin Cities are taking a look around on both sides of the bay. And that trend is expected to continue. Some say we could have the hottest winter market for real estate in decades.
Well, another issue slightly related to real estate in Superior. You've got to update, Brooks, on the BNSF taconite dust payment issue?
Yes, this week the Superior City Council passed a resolution unanimously calling on BNSF, the railroad company, to resume payments to Alois neighborhood residents. In the neighborhood, which is near the Alois taconite facility, taconite dust builds up on homes, on windows and walls, siding, roofs. And for decades, BNSF has been paying about $200 to $500 to around 200 households. A lot of those payments suddenly stopped without warning this summer, as the railroad said it's looking into irregularities that resulted in some claims being paid that were not near the facility. City Councilor Jenny Van Sickle said she's been in touch with the railroad and expects conversations to continue to reach a conclusion.
So does this action by the council mean that BNSF has to make the payments?
What this does is put public pressure on the company to resume a precedent it started nearly 50 years ago. To my knowledge and the knowledge of the council, there is no actual written agreement that mandates that these payments be made.
All right. Another story updating from last week, a domestic violence shelter that had its funding cut due to support of Black Lives Matter. Something new on that, Danny?
Yeah, this week, Barron County Sheriff Chris Fitzgerald put out a statement on Facebook regarding some of the national attention to, as you said, their decision to back out from support of the domestic violence victims organization Embrace. You know, he stressed that no victim services have been lost and that Embrace is still serving people in need in the area. He announced that he's launching a citizen advisory and action team for the department that will include members from diverse backgrounds to advise and challenge the department on issues of race, social justice, and equality. But he really didn't back down from his previous stance. He feels that their decision has nothing to do with race and more to do with the statement of Black Lives Matter to defund or support defunding of the police. He said that the reason for their withdrawal of the department's support was due to a request for Embrace to not publicly support any movement that supports defunding the police. But he said that they can and will do better every day and talk and tackle issues of social justice and other things that might come up in the community, and looks forward to holding a conversation more about that within the community.
Well, we'll take that as a small victory toward understanding on all sides there. We've been speaking with Danielle Kading, the Superior-based reporter for WPR News. Thank you, Danny.
Thanks, Robin.
And we also were joined by Brooks Johnson of the Star Tribune's North Report team. Thank you, Brooks.
Thanks so much, Robin.
You can read the stories by Brooks and the Star Tribune's entire Twin Ports Bureau at www.startribune.com/northreport. And be sure to subscribe to their local newsletter. Coming up next week on Simply Superior. Is your ship coming in, or are you finally getting ready to get on a plane? We'll talk about all things transportation with our resident expert, Dr. Richard Stewart.
For the first time since March, TSA did the search on a million passengers in a day.
And that's it for this edition of Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. Stay safe, everyone.
Simply Superior, news and issues from a superior point of view. Gathered to mirror your life and interests with the goal of helping you to understand the world we live in and the region we hold dear. By sharing the stories and information you'll enjoy and want to hear.